All right, can you hear me? This is becoming a ritual. Okay, it's on, right? You can hear. All right, good. I solve a problem of where to put the microphone. I bought a fanny pack. So Nancy got her belt back, and her pants will stay up. I'm going to talk this afternoon. This morning I talked about, in traditional Christological formulas, about the 4th century, there was a split that happened in discussions of Christology and Jesus that divided what was called Christology proper from soteriology, so that doctrines around who Jesus in and of himself as true God and true man and all those questions became called Christology, and what he did to save us became called soteriology. And it's an artificial division. It was a division not made in the early church. But for purposes of neatness, we made the same division for today. So this morning I talked a lot about soteriology, and this afternoon I'm going to talk about incarnation. Because that's the other question is, well, then who is Jesus if we redefine sin and salvation? And I'm going to begin with a question from this morning, which is actually what I was going to start with anyway, which is the question of Jesus' maleness. It's the question that Rosemary Ruther asked when she said, "Can a male Savior save women?" And if Jesus is the incarnation of God, then is God male? Now, the first point I want to make about this question is, feminists did not create the problem of the maleness of Jesus. Church authorities created this problem by elevating his maleness to an ontological status. Right? So every other particularity about Jesus, his race, his language, his religion, you don't even have to be Jewish to be ordained, his religion. You might think that was an important criterion, but his religion, his culture, none of those other things that make him a human being were elevated to an ontological status as qualification for ordination. Right? So it's Jesus' maleness that becomes an idol and a club against women. And feminists did not do that. This is what the church did to Jesus. They made maleness a symbol of power and exclusion. It's interesting even that in the Christian church, especially in Northern Europe and North America, they were willing to change Jesus' race. This blonde, blue-eyed, Nordic Jesus that we have all seen on our Sunday school walls and in our churches, they were quite willing to change that. And the African-American tradition got the clue and decided to make Jesus black, and that's been very empowering to their tradition, but not his sex. So the problem of Jesus' maleness is a long-standing problem in the church. Feminists didn't invent it and were not the ones to make it a problem. Now, the irony, I think, of this, this is a strange irony, is that once they elevated Jesus' maleness to this high status, and it became virtually the only disqualifying factor for not getting ordained as if you were female, it's sort of like my friend Maureen used to say, you don't have to be like Jesus, you just have to pee like Jesus to get ordained. It all. that in elevating his maleness, this qualification to this ontological status, that there's an agenda about rejecting women's authority and power, which is of course tied to birth and sexuality for women. So it led to an incredible kind of squeamishness about things bodily. So they, in elevating Jesus' maleness to this status, also neutered him. Isn't this odd? So there's this docetic tendency to disembody Jesus, to as Mary Daly said, paint him in the very spiritual direction, but he loses all of his humanity. He becomes this perfect, high, elevated being. And of course, in the Middle Ages, he became like God, this righteous judge that was really vindictive and nasty. And so it's odd that after making maleness so important, then they spiritualize him and sort of take his body away from him. And both of those are moves, I think, that are misogynist moves. That's the thing that links them. They seem contradictory, but the link is the misogynist move. And women have paid the price for this, where sexuality has been devalued, and we are sexuality, therefore we are the problem, we cause men's sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all part of the dynamic of this misogyny, I think, and we have been coping with the aftermath ever since. So I want to say the problem of Jesus' maleness is not our invention. And because of that question, a number of other questions like the anti-Jewish element in certain doctrines of the Incarnation, their imperialist implications and things like that, there are a number of traditional ways incarnation has been defined in the Christian tradition that I think feminists don't even bother with, or have just decided that these are not true. And of course, one of the important ones is the rejection that the incarnation of Jesus as God is some kind of exclusive, once and for all, never again revelation of God's true self. That kind of exclusivist claim, I think, has highly political connotations. It's partly an anti-Jewish agenda. It's a partly anti-female agenda. It has it's an imperialist agenda about we have the truth and no one else does, and it's a hierarchical agenda. So the claim that the early church made about Jesus, that he, in some sense, was the Christ, some embodiment of a messianic tradition, of which there are a number of messiahs, including foreigners like Cyrus the Persian king, that the claim that Jesus, in some sense, embodied a messianic hope gets turned into kind of elevated ontological status that only he can do. And Kwok Pui Lan raises the question from the Chinese perspective of, well, if God was over there in Jesus, where was God in the Tang Dynasty in China? So it's like, well, Calvin and Luther debated this, actually, and Calvin decided logically it didn't make sense to have Jesus subsume God wholly because there's the creator aspect of God and who was holding up the rest of the world if God is wholly subsumed in Jesus. So this isn't a new question in the doctrine of the incarnation, but the claim that this is some wholly subsuming incarnation of God has been rejected by most feminists. And Dolores Williams in her lecture last year points out that we also seem to forget that the incarnation came first to a woman. Now, Jesus is Mary's son, and the Spirit came first in Mary's body. So it didn't begin with, if you're going to accept this doctrine of the incarnation in a particular form, it didn't begin with Jesus, but it begins with the revelation to Mary and the Spirit in her. And the African-American tradition has a long tradition of understanding Jesus as Mary's son, and Mary as a suffering mother who loses her son. The other problem with traditional understandings of the incarnation is that even though the doctrine says this is a union of spirit and flesh, it's very interesting, it's a union of spirit and flesh. Flesh being a very concrete, earthy term, a very sensual term. That union combines the spirit with the flesh. But in the way the doctrine of the incarnation has worked, we're supposed to not like that flesh. That we're supposed to gravitate toward the spiritual side of this. And the way Jesus has been described has also shifted the union of the integration of the incarnation in a spiritualized direction. So even though in the Gospels we have quite a physical Jesus who gets tired, who gets angry, who eats, who feeds other people, who spits in the dirt to make a healing poultice, who does all kinds of very tangible, embodied, and physical things, we get this image that if you're really like Jesus, you're more spiritual. but you don't have this messy body that gets in your way. So both of those elements of the incarnation, the exclusivism of it and the denial of the flesh, the minimizing of the flesh, are things that feminists have begun to challenge. So what do feminists think of the incarnation? Well, Dolores Williams last year talked about how when she explained to a colleague that she didn't think we needed this atonement and that it was highly problematic, and his question to her was, well, then what are you willing to die for? And she said, nothing. She said, that's the martyr's question. If you want to ask it, somebody will answer for you and kill you. Somebody will return your favor, and if you're willing to die for somebody, somebody will make sure you will die for it. So that's the wrong question. Just the real question is, what are you willing to live for? And that's the question we have to ask of Jesus' life. It's not what he, why he died or what he died for, but what was he living for? What was his life? What is the witness we find in the text about who he was in his community? What traditions he called upon, and what he did. That's far more important than how he died. And it's in some sense that life asks us the same question. What are we willing to live for? Where are our passions for love and justice and our commitments to life? So that's the first question. The first issue is that it's Jesus' life that's the focus of the incarnation. The second thing is that the incarnation is how we as human beings speak about the mystery of God in our lives, about God present with us, and how our passions for life and relationship erupt in paradox and mystery and in experiences so beyond our capacity to speak of them that we are often silenced by their transformative impact on our lives. And so the incarnation is about that kind of mystery, about that sacred presence. And as an aspect of that mystery and sacred presence, it's an ongoing process. That incarnation didn't happen once and for all, but it is an ongoing process that began at the first moment of creation, when the breath of God, the Spirit of God, moved across the face of the waters and is the first principle of all that came to be. So that incarnation is about that Spirit dwelling here in everything that is. Not in one place or one person, but in everything that is. And it is good. It is blessed and a gift. That's the first principle of incarnation. Second place, important place we find this indwelling Spirit of God, just track this through the Bible, it's a very interesting story of the Spirit, is when the people are in the wilderness and facing chaos, and they want to go home to Egypt because they'd rather be slaves than face the unknown of the wilderness, the Spirit comes and dwells with them as a Spirit that guides and comforts and gives hope. So that's another mark of the Spirit, of this incarnate Spirit. And it comes also in Proverbs 8, the infamous Sophia text. Right? It is the Spirit that comes and dwells with us in our streets and in our homes, who calls to us to be prudent, to be wise, to be discerning, to think about our lives, to pay attention. It's also a Spirit that causes trouble. It is a restless spirit. It moves where it will. It cannot be controlled. It erupts in places where we least expect it, like a gathering of women. And in places that make us uncomfortable. It's like Suge's line in The Color Purple, God loves everything you love and a whole mess of things you don't love. It's a voice that calls to us to challenge us as well as comfort. So the Spirit isn't just comfort, it's also challenge. Because the Spirit dwells in the physical universe, in the flesh, in the body, in the earth, everything that happens to us happens to God. In other words, what happens to us, what we do to each other, what we do to the earth, matters to God. So we have a responsibility to take care, to protect, to guard. One of the other questions from this morning was the question of God's omnipotence. And if we accept this understanding that where God dwells with us, God dwells in the Spirit, and that Spirit is a spirit of life-giving love and justice, that there is this incredible life energy in the universe that is a witness to the power of this Spirit, it is not an omnipotent power. Just like love is not about omnipotence and control. In fact, it's this need for control, this idea of omnipotence, that's part of the problem. Nell Noddings, in her book Women and Evil, talks about this problem of control, where she argues that the whole way the Western Christian tradition has conceived of good and evil as a bifurcated kind of dualism where you have goodness and God and the Spirit and heaven and all these things on one side, and you have evil and sin and death and destruction and woman on the other side, that what you have is a basic model of human life and history as conflict, because the point of the bifurcation is that good should triumph over and control evil for everything to be okay. So it's a model of reality as fundamentally conflict-driven. And she argues it favors masculine virtue, what she calls masculine virtue. It favors the need to dominate, to win, and to control. Because that's how the world is okay. The good side controls the bad side. And it's a very unambiguous picture of life. It doesn't acknowledge that often the things that are the powers for good can turn into evil, because power is ambiguous. She argues that, in fact, the way women experience, not just women, I think human beings experience what is problematic in our lives, if you want to use the word evil or bad or difficult, is that we experience certain things like irredeemable pain as a kind of evil. Somebody who inflicts torture simply to inflict pain and misuses power to inflict pain, that is an evil thing. As is enduring pain for no purpose. To live with a terminal illness where the pain is going to escalate and nothing can be done. That is a kind of awful thing. And so she argues that that kind of pain is evil, if you want to use that word. As is the feeling that we often have of helplessness in the face of pain. The sense that we can do nothing to make things right, that we can do nothing to help another or help ourselves. So that feeling powerless is an awful thing. And the third thing she identifies as problematic is being separated from those we love. The breaking of loving, nurturing, caring relationships is a great evil. So she argues that, to summarize, pain and helplessness and separation are how we really experience tragedy and evil in our lives. And that, in fact, it's the desire to dominate and win and control that create pain, separation, and helplessness. So that the way we have actually even conceived of good and evil create evil. This is the paradox of the way we think about good and evil. And So the issue is that when love is incarnate, when we are working in loving ways, the issue is not trying to control or win or dominate another, because love is not about that kind of power. Love is about minimizing pain, empowering willful action, and creating relationships of connection and love and care. Now, those are powerful things. The capacity to alleviate someone else's pain, the capacity to help another feel empowered to do what they need to do, to empower their creativity or their action in their lives for work for justice or whatever we do to empower others, to create relationships of love and care and nurture. Those are powerful, powerful acts. Those are evidence, I think, of the incarnate Spirit of God in our midst. But they're not omnipotent acts. And they're quite fragile. Relationships of love and care and nurture are both strong and fragile at the same time. And that's the paradox, the mystery of life. That so much of what is strong is also weak or fragile. So incarnation is not about control. It's not about omnipotence. It's about relationality. It's about love and care. It's about love and justice. So I would argue that incarnation as relational doesn't just reside in any particular place. We recognize its moments when it reaches out to us or grabs us in a particularly extraordinary way. And it's important to honor those moments. So the Christian tradition has honored that moment in the life of Jesus Christ. That's an important kind of moment of honoring. But it's a moment of honoring, not all that there is. And in fact, the Black tradition, the African-American tradition, has a whole history of Black messiahs. They understand this principle that you constantly have to have people working for justice reappearing. Because it didn't just happen once then. If it happened just once then why were they enslaved? So the issue is not where, is what is incarnation? How do we recognize it? How do we use what we know about the love of God to confront misuses of power? It seems to me that one of the most important testimonies to this incarnate Spirit of God is the story of Pentecost, the story of the birth of the church, because this is a story of how the Spirit, indifference does not divide. That how we are different from each other is not a way that we fight and divide each other. That we all strive in some way across the lines of our differences to understand each other. And when we do that, we encounter this Spirit that empowers us to endure pain, that empowers us to connect to each other, to try to understand, to think wisely and to live well, to seek comfort in the chaos of the wilderness of our lives, to work for justice and to live in whole-making ways. And the New Testament text clearly paints a picture of a community and of a figure named Jesus who obviously struggles to do these things. Not perfectly, not completely, but in an important way. And most importantly, the text affirms this bodily life. This physical, the healing stories are about people being touched in their bodies. Being in some sense made whole. Maybe not perfect. Being whole is not to be made perfect. It's simply in some sense to be integrated and at peace with yourself, whatever that is. But it's about that process. So I'm going to close. I think incarnation is about mystery and about life lived in this body and about our creative imagination. And so I'm going to end with one of my favorite poems by Mary Oliver. It's from a book called Dreamwork. She's become one of my favorite incarnational poets. It's from a book called Dreamwork, and the title of the poem is just poem. The spirit likes to dress up like this. 10 fingers, 10 toes, shoulders, and all the rest. At night, in the black branches, in the morning, in the blue branches of the world. It could float, of course, but would rather plumb rough matter. Airy and shapeless thing, it needs the metaphor of the body. Lime and appetite, the oceanic fluids, it needs the body's world, instinct and imagination, and the dark hug of time. Sweetness, tangibility, to be understood, to be more than pure light that burns where no one is. So it enters us. In the morning, shines from brute comfort like a stitch of lightning, and at night, lights up the deep and wondrous drownings of the body like a star. Amen.